Well, hello everyone. Welcome back, courageous people. I started a little bit late, not because I wanted to start late, but because after coffee break, I know people are drifting. So that's why we did that. And I can't stand for people to miss the first couple minutes. So let us open with a word of gratitude. And may I ask you to stand, if you are able, and just assume whatever posture of gratitude comes to you as we have a word of gratitude. And I really mean that. Our bodies can say it, but sometimes we're uncomfortable with how other people see us expressing our bodies. So if everyone doesn't mind just closing your eyes, so no one else is gazing at you as you be whatever your body does with gratitude. But gracious God, we give you great thanks. We give you great thanks for the whole community of communities that enables us to breathe now, to be alive now. We give thanks for the trees of the Amazon and the Cascades that give us oxygen. We give thanks for the bees that pollinated the plants that made our bread in Syria. We give thanks for the thousands of organisms in a foot of soil that grew the peaches and the oranges. We give thanks for the trillions of organisms in our bodies, all the little animalitos that are buzzing and whirling and swirling and flowing within us, the little creatures in our eyes, in our tear ducts, the creatures in our intestines, all the little microbes on our skin. Just feel them. There are trillions of them scurrying about your body. Just think of it. Take a breath and recognize that the trees gave you breath. We give thanks for the ancestors in our bloodline, whose lives birthed our lives. We give thanks for the companions that give us strength and joy. Oh, holy mystery that is flowing and pouring through all things, grant that we might receive and see and savor. Grant that we might relish being alive. Give us courage. Give us wisdom to know how to love with justice-seeking love now in our time. Give us hope. Give us joy. Give us self-forgiveness. We give great thanks that you are within us and with us and beyond us. Amen.
Amen.
It is an amazing thing to be alive. I was in a Buddhist temple in Seattle a few years ago, and I read just a wee bit of a book in the library, and the Buddhist saying of to be alive as a human being is precious, rare, and infinitely meaningful. Mm-hmm. And it felt so real to me. So here we are. May I ask, how many of you were not here yesterday? Wow. Okay. All right. We're going to pivot just a little bit. Let me ask you all of you who were here yesterday, take 30 seconds to think. What do you take away? What is important to you to know from yesterday? Give yourselves about 30 seconds. Okay, let me hear from a few people. Let us hear from a few people.
The next 3 years are very pivotal.
The next 3 years are pivotal. Okay, absolutely. And someone pointed out something, someone who was here yesterday pointed out to me actually a mistake I had made. He didn't put it in those terms. I talked about we're on a precipice, and on one side is monumental climate catastrophe that in which those who are least responsible for it are suffering the most. And then I said the other side is the vision before us of a life in which Earth can flourish and all can have the necessities for it. That really isn't a possibility now, okay, in the near future. The possibility now is, I hate to say this, jeez, I wasn't even gonna say this, but it is the degree of climate catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And some people will say, given that we can't turn it back, let's just go on and do what we're doing. But that is false, because the degree of catastrophe is very, very different from if we radically reduce carbon emissions to if we don't. Okay, what else came out from yesterday? And if it's repeating something I just said, that's okay.
A climate privilege.
Pardon me?
Climate privilege.
The concept, had anyone heard that term before? Okay, the concept of climate privilege, that some of us are privileged in the negative sense, mm-hmm, not the positive sense, that though we are one of the societies most responsible per capita for climate change, we also are, and now I'm using we in a couple of different ways, we as the U.S. are one of the societies most responsible, and many parts of we in the U.S. are more equipped to protect ourselves and avoid the dangers and not be subject to them, at least for the near future. Whereas within our world and within our nation, there are people far more vulnerable. People vulnerable because of no health care. So when the smoke from the fires hits in California, I can go inside my house. But many people got stuck outside because they live on the streets, or they live right near the, they live in places where they can't have protection from the decent air. Okay, so some are climate vulnerable, and some of the obvious climate vulnerable are people in the lowlands that will be flooded, the island nations that will be no longer habitable. Okay, good, climate privilege. Other key concepts, yes?
Climate colonialism.
Climate colonialism. Okay, that term, there. Thank you, that we, oh my goodness, how beautifully that term links with your work in decolonizing. Yeah. Woo. Woo. We could just take a whole new stream right here and go with it. But the term I learned from the church in India, that we are, as he said, powerful societies and sectors within them are colonizing the atmospheric commons. Mm-hmm. After having colonized Africa and Australia and Latin America and parts of Asia, now colonizing the atmospheric commons. Okay, any other key things? Yes?
How are faith motivates us to take action.
Okay, the idea that inherent in the call to you will love your neighbor as yourself is justice seeking, because that love is a norm that Jesus learned from the Hebrew prophets. So Jesus wasn't talking about that we're just called to care about one another individually only, but we're called to a love that is justice seeking and earth loving, earth caring. So our faith, so you open up another hole, and this is part of what we'll spend time on tomorrow also. The ways in which our faith in Jesus, in the God whom Jesus loved, and I would argue that faith in most of the world's great religious traditions calls us to act, to do. Okay, so those, yes, one more.
Faith communities are working for just transition.
You all could be planted. We've talked about climate colonialism, climate privilege, the call of faith to act, and now just transition. Yes, and that's, thank you. That is another key concept that is arising. It's been around for a while, but it's really taking shape in the public discourse now. And it means transition to renewable energy societies, non-carbon emitting societies, particularly economies, because it's our economic ways, the ways we do business, what we produce, what we consume, how we distribute, etc., that are producing the fossil fuels. So a transition to a renewable energy society, but done justly, meaning with a racial equity lens and an economic equity lens, so that the most vulnerable do not get damaged. And the most vulnerable can be damaged. Look at biofuels. You know, what a positive thing biofuels have been and can be, and the croplands that they took, the food lands that they could no longer grow foods. Okay, very good. So a just transition bit. And I will say also, how many of you are related to the ELCA in one way? Okay, the ELCA, and here's one resource for you. Get a hold of our public policy office in Washington, D.C. Go online, get the phone number, get the email. It's called the Lutheran Office on Governmental Affairs. And contact Ruth Ivory Moore, I-V-O-R-Y hyphen Moore. I've got it on my handout. Who is the person responsible for environmental justice legislative work in the ELCA. And she is doing work on just transition and is enabling people in the church to do that. Very involved also in the Paris climate talks, etc. And that's a key. So bring that concept up in your cities when they're doing legislation around climate, etc. Talk about that it must have a racial equity and economic equity lens. Okay, good. So you've brought up many of the things that we spoke about yesterday. Let me ask one other question of you, and that is, what question is in your mind? And take a minute just quietly to note the questions in your mind. Let's hear from two or three people. What question do you want responded to by the end of this week, coming out of yesterday? Okay. No questions.
Mm-hmm. No, I have a question.
Pardon me?
Prioritizing of energy, public and private. You know, where is it best for us to put our private energy, and where is it best to us join in the public commons on
that? Okay, where to put our energy as individuals, and where should the greater society be putting prioritizing its energy? Beautiful question. Yes, please.
How do we bring the things that we need to the poor parts of the world who need to want to develop and yet still do it in a way that is saving our planet?
Okay, big, hot question. Big, hot question. Like, do not tell a nation that does not have energy for its people yet to not produce energy, because that's going to screw up the rest of the world. So how do we contribute to the enabling increased consumption and increased energy in places that no longer have it, but without reproducing environmental damage? Okay, I'm not going to answer any of these questions right now, but I like, it's so important to put our questions on the table, because questions can sabotage us. We can have questions and no tools for responding, and they can keep us from acting. So bear in mind, noting to yourselves your questions as we go on. We did, yesterday, journey into the data of despair. We talked, we did some truth-telling about what is going on. I want to honor your courage in coming back. And I honor your courage as we go out of this place to work toward just transitions. Today, I would like, after yesterday's immersion into the data of despair, today we will talk more about what we as individuals, as church communities, as other communities can do. Tomorrow, we'll talk more about the question of where do we find the moral, spiritual power, the hope to go on despite the truth-telling that we must do. Wherein lies the fortitude? Where do we drink hope? So that will be the topic more for tomorrow. So, to open the question of what are we to do, you all remember Václav Havel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, president of the Czech Republic, former president of the Czech Republic. In one of his speeches, it was an international address, he made a question, and I'm paraphrasing it, or I'm quoting it not exactly accurately. He asked, one of the most burning questions before humankind is why we carry on with ways of doing and being that are killing us.
Mm-hmm.
Why? So I want to pose that question to you for a moment. Why are you, and why are other people that you know not? So our house is on fire. Why are we sitting around? I'm not asking that of you any more than I'm asking it of me. In other words, that's not an accusatory question. It's a question that I think is vitally important. Why, if the next 3 years, if these are the most, as one climate scientist said that we quoted yesterday, the most important 5 years in human history, why are we not highly engaged? And that why I'm talking about kind of existentially in different ways. On the most pragmatic level, what is stopping us? For instance, the need to spend time and energy making a living, or getting where you're going, or so very pragmatic wise, as well as, you know, more kind of esoteric wise, so philosophical. Why, concretely speaking, am I not devoting myself more to putting out the fire? Do you understand my question?
Mm-hmm.
Would you take a minute just to think about it? You know, if your kids were in a house and the other side of the house was on fire and the fire was approaching, wouldn't you be trying to put it out? So, what do you think? You as society, why are we not doing? Yes, please.
It seems like what I've read is that as human beings, we're not evolutionarily prepared to respond to a danger that's not immediate, that we can't see and perceive in this moment. So the house is not on fire. Like, if the house were burning, we would run out of it. But we don't, we look around, we don't see the house burning.
Okay, so it's not, we're not experiencing the catastrophe right now. And does something go with that, that the fact that we may realize that others are, but it doesn't hit home?
Yeah.
Okay. Very, very, very significant. Yeah. Very significant. Here and then over here. Yes. Could you all say your names when you first speak also?
Sure. My name is Paul.
Paul.
It almost feels like the house is on fire and we are fighting with a squirt gun. And we called the fire department and they haven't come.
We're doing it with a squirt gun, like just changing light bulbs and nothing else. I'm not putting down changing light bulbs. That's why we, but just, and we've called up the fire department. You mean the political powers that be?
Correct.
And there's no response. Okay.
Yep.
Interesting. Yes. And her name is
Andrea. And I think my point is related to Paul's in that in my reading, it seems that any one individual's actions are unlikely to make a significant difference. And given the need for broad-scale structural changes and the political climate in which we live, in which those types of structural changes are increasingly unlikely, it seems, it just is hard for, I think, some individuals, myself included at times, to muster the will to do things that are more uncomfortable and more inconvenient and more expensive if you don't think ultimately it will make.
Apathy or
Structural incentives are pointing in the wrong direction.
Structural incentives are, and it's that paradox of, and we'll talk about that paradox of one individual's actions won't change the world at all, and yet individual's actions are absolutely necessary.
So there's one term that's used for this, and it's called a wicked problem.
Wicked problems. Yes, wicked problems that are so big that they need to be dealt with structurally, but structurally there isn't the political will or the structural incentives to do it. There are incentives to do the opposite. Very good. So it's, we'll call it that, a wicked problem. And then Paul. Well, remind me the point that you made, because it was the squirt gun issue and the fire department not responding. Yeah, and then over here, the person's name we didn't get.
Alan.
Oh yeah, but evolutionarily, we're not prepared to respond to issues that aren't
immediate or seen or experienced.
Evolutionarily. Yeah.
Is there a darker marker you could use?
Oh, we can't see that. Yeah. Thank you for asking that. Yes, there is a darker marker. Yes.
Elizabeth, I guess related to some of these wicked problem issues, I think there's a feeling of aloneness, like looking around and saying, well, this is a terrible problem, but nobody else seems panicked. Nobody else seems to think the house is on fire. So should I take these actions and be uncomfortable? And am I crazy for thinking this is a problem?
Very real. I mean, even if you are someplace and there's a disaster and no one else notices, you think you're crazy and you don't get the sheep behavior almost. Yeah. A couple of others. Let's see. Ron.
Not to pass the buck. But, 40-50% of this country denied that there's a pile of houses even on fire? And subsequent to that, if the government would step in and, give us directive as in World War II, they would say, you're taking away my freedom,
Resistance to government intervention.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes. And then, yes, right here, and then Carol.
My name is...
You're both Carols?
No. My name is Liz, people with economic and political power are making a lot of money off the house being on fire. They're not just not fighting the fire, they are making money, like a lot of money.
Okay, you know the largest emitters, I just read it on the way up here, the largest emitters of carbon, of greenhouse gases, are a few companies that are making mountains of money. Many of them are fossil fuel companies. So that's the economic incentives to keep on making money off of maximizing profit by polluting. Yeah.
You know, I don't know how prevalent this is now, but we have this faith in technology in the United States. And we assume that some scientific development is going to come through this.
Yeah, it's a false confidence in that technology will save us. And technology is vitally necessary, but alone is not going to save us. Okay, yes.
David, I think many people are too busy putting out small fires.
Yes.
So that they don't have the time to even consider that there's a bigger fire going on, a conflagration.
Uh-huh. Too busy putting out small fires. Very, very real. Okay, we're going to do, there was some, Carol was in the back.
I just tie together the aloneness and the last comment. Carol, chief. There's a fatigue. There's sort of a fatigue that any kind of change is, we have to step out of the rut. We have to somehow bump ourselves out of the rut to be able to make forward progress.
You all are so smart. I mean, really, knowing these things, but we are creatures. The more you read neuroscience, we're creatures that our neurons and the synapses and the wiring up there keeps going along in the way things are. You know, what fires together is wired together. And it takes intentionality to get out of the rut. Very, very good point. One more, and then we'll move on.
John is my name, and I think it's also important, we don't listen to the one or the ones who are most affected by climate change have the least voice. Mm-hmm. I spent 6 months in Shishmaref, Alaska, because the church put a church up there, and it's sinking.
Yeah.
And they speak, it's sinking. It's Shishmaref, Alaska is a barrier island 22 miles from the Arctic Circle, and it's sinking rapidly. And the only reason there's a village there is because the government and the church put a school and a church there. Otherwise, it would be a spot on the transportation. But one of the individuals that I attended a meeting while there, and he talked about local knowledge not being respected. Yeah. It's not, the engineers come up, take a look at the place, they say, oh, here's the problem, here's how we fix it. And then the guy looks at him and says, what about our local experience? And so it's local experience is discounted.
Yeah. Very, very real. And that is part of the colonialized mentality also. To listen to the experts, but not to listen to the voices of the people suffering most.
Yeah.
One principle of ethics, I teach Christian ethics, is that moral deliberations and actions will be flawed, sometimes fatally, if we don't hear and heed the voices on the margins of power and privilege. And that would be many of the suffering voices now. I don't want to ignore you in the back seat with a white sweatshirt on. Yes?
Well, it may have been covered earlier, but we have a tendency to believe that every idea, every opinion, every observation has equal weight.
Okay, this idea, very, very dangerous. Very, very dangerous. And that comes out of kind of false assumptions of what makes for freedom or what makes for equality, that we should listen to all voices equally. And voices that are deceitful and denying and motivated by rendering further denial aren't worthy of the same hearing. Some of the same, read the book called Merchants of
Venice.
No, Merchants of Denial. I'll think of it later. but it's a book that documents that the very same, some of the very same scientists that were employed to promote tobacco, to spread the idea that tobacco was safer on the world, are much older now, but have been hired to also promote climate denial. Yeah. Okay, so what are we to do? What kind of practices and what kind of ways of life and ways of being church are going to reverse the trajectory that we're on, this trajectory of a torrential movement toward increased, the trajectory we're on will ultimately, if we don't reverse it, will undo the human species as well as many other species. So what I would like to do, we don't have a lot of time in this hour and the next 2 days, but I'd like to have us generate a toolbox. And it's a toolbox for conversion to earth-honoring and justice-seeking ways of being human and ways of being church. I have a book that I did in 2013 called Resisting Structural Evil, Love as Ecological Economic Vocation. And that is a part of what that book is trying to do, is create such a toolbox. So today we'll draw some tools that are explored further in that text. I'd like us to work with about 5 tools. And the first one we did yesterday. And that was the tool of moral spiritual vision. And if you recall, that was holding on to seeing 3 things at once, or seeing through 3 lenses. The first is what is going on. Truth telling about what is going on, especially where structural evil masquerades as good. So the life we live masquerades as the good life. It's called the good life. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's undermining Earth's capacity to sustain life. So that's what I mean by masquerading good, evil masquerading as good. So seeing what is going on. Secondly, seeing alternatives, more just and compassionate and ecological alternatives, already in the making and in the imagining. And third, seeing the power and presence of that sacred reality that we call God, that is, according to the, that is luring us and drawing us and empowering us to move from the way things are toward the way things are. So that's the first tool. The second tool is recognizing that, recognizing the different levels, and this gets right smack at what you were talking about the wicked problem and the issue of what one person does can't change the world, but what one person does is vitally important, that whole interface of forms of action. It gets to your question up in the top row there of where we ought to prioritize our energies. So seeing that change happens on 5 different levels of social life. And one of those levels is the household. We'll just say that, the individual level, the household. A second level, and these are not, I'm not putting these by importance, I'm just making, so second doesn't mean secondary, it means another, is institutions of civil society, such as churches, denominations, other worshiping communities, schools, those institutions that are neither business nor public policy. So we can think, and we'll think in more detail about that, but for instance, a school, my seminary, has gone through a 3-year process to become certified as a Green Justice Seminary. So that's an institution of civil society. So now we only, we do many, many, many things to change the institution. Then the third level is public policy. So public policy on local and national local and state or provincial, if when we're in a different kind of body politic, and national and international. So we see all of those. We see the incredible work being done on international levels through the UN processes, the big Paris summit and the annual summits that are going on are examples of that. And the ELCA is involved in those. National public policy, we see all that can go on there, and state and local. We were talking last night at dinner about the power of local public policy. Okay, so that's a third. A fourth is business. Mm-hmm. Significant change in the ways, massive change in the ways that business and especially our large corporate structures operate. Okay, we'll go into more detail. And then fifth, worldview or consciousness or the stories we live by. And in here lies theology. I'd like to, before we talk in more detail about any of these, I'd like us to put a little bit of flesh on that last one, because it seems like the most maybe wooey-wooey or esoteric or hard to get a grasp on. And some people, it's interesting. Well, let's just talk. What do I mean by the stories we live by or worldview? Can you think of examples of worldviews, assumptions that contribute to climate disastrous ways of living?
Trump.
Let me, yes.
That God gave us dominion over the earth.
Okay. Very significant.
We couldn't hear up here.
Thank you for saying that. And that is, by the way, one of a little ground rule that I called forth yesterday that I'd like to call forth again today. If you can't hear a word someone else says, let us know so that we can all hear all the words. It's especially important with a masked life. So that God gave humans dominion. Now, that has many forms. Another form is that God gave white humans dominion. And that has been the most, supposedly the most read article in intellectual history, was written in 1967 or 64 by a historian of science and technology, White, Lynn White. And it was an article that he wrote in a journal that basically identified Jewish and Christian traditions of dominion theology as a fundamental root of the ecological crisis. Mm-hmm. And that article, I still assign it sometimes in classes. It's been read throughout history, it's been debated, but it is part of what started the Christian and Jewish ecological movements. Because, and there is truth to his article. The fact that the assumption that the earth is there for us to use, for human, so that's part of our psyche. That's part of manifest destiny. That's part of why all the logging happened. It's part of why we pollute rivers. So it's an assumption that is inculcated in us. That's been a prominent theological plane, and so now there's a role of theology. That text is being reread and re-understood and refuted. So dominion theologies are being critiqued, but that's a very good example of the stories we live by that need to be known and named. If you don't know it and name it, we don't recognize that we assume it, and then we go on with it. So a very, very good example.
Something that I think is baked into our DNA is the whole idea of the tension between scarcity and abundance.
Okay, say a little bit more.
Well, we act as if there's not enough, and so that pushes us out to, you know, to consume and produce.
Okay, so that opens up to many, many terrains that we could go down of worldviews. But the worldview that we need to be, that there isn't enough, and so we need to get, mm-hmm. we need to get because there isn't enough, whereas there is enough.
Yes.
The problem is how it's distributed. Mm-hmm. Famine, what's the book? Victorian Holocausts, I think, is the name of the book. But an author who documents the extent to which famine throughout history has not been caused by lack of food. It's been caused by distribution of food. Okay.
So the comment on that is there's enough to feed the poor, there isn't enough to feed the rich.
Okay, that's another way of putting it. So both of those things get at something really important. The worldview, the assumption that if I own it, I have the right to do what I want with it. Mm-hmm. If I own it, I have the right to do what I want with it. So if I have the money, I have the right to spend it. Mm-hmm. So I own it. I have the capacity to fly a lot. So I have the right to fly mm-hmm. a lot. Don't I have the right to? Or I have the right to drive a fossil fuel car that spews forth a big car, even though I don't need it. But I have the right to. But what makes us think we have the right to do things that are when we look at the impact of our collective lives that are horribly damaging? Or I have this company and therefore I have the right to dump its scuzz into the Rio Grande, even though the scuzz is so bad that when I was taking delegations of people to the border, I was pregnant back then, and we were going to the border, and the people we were working with, because we wanted to see the maquiladoras and what's going on in the border, they wouldn't let me go because it was too dangerous for a pregnant woman to go there. And yet that's where multiple women were working, all the pregnant women, and having babies born without brains that could last because of it. But the company has the right because they own it. Okay, so that's another. So all we're doing right now is we're just talking about the power of the narratives. Another narrative is that human beings are not part of nature. We're apart from nature. So we do it all the time. We say, let's pray for humans and nature. We should be shifting that worldview to pray for humans and the rest of nature. So the narratives that shape us by virtue of our language. Look what we talked about yesterday. Was it in whose class were we talking about the use of black and black associated with bad stuff, with demons, with dementors, with all kinds of things, so that creates a narrative that black is dangerous or not good. So naming the narratives that undergird how we live and then shifting those narratives. And worship is powerful in that. How can we worship in ways that say that we are mammals? And the fact of us being apart from nature means that our economies are apart from nature's economy. So we don't need to attend to. So remember in the 1970s when the limits to growth came out and we began to realize that, oh my gosh, our economies need to be embedded in the economy of the earth. So we can't just use up, colonize the atmospheric commons. We need to take it into consideration in our economy. We can know, so a company externalizing profits, externalizing externalities, whatever we call it, externalizing the damaging that we're done, so it's not a part of the bottom line. So the narrative of that we're not, so one of the ways that I can remember trying to undo this narrative that we are apart from nature, I gave a talk once that was called, it was on ecofeminism. Oh, Adam, you know the word Adam is not a male in the Bible until Adam is a generic noun. So I gave a talk called Adam Was Not a Guy and Jesus Was a Mammal. Just as a way of saying we're mammals in an ecosystem. And we better pay attention. Mammals don't destroy their ecosystem if they're okay, so the narratives, that's one level. Worldview, consciousness, narrative. So, one of the realities is that a lot of folks Well, and I can say this as students, will say that what we need is change on that first level, lifestyles. Everyone needs to change their lifestyle. It's not going to, and that will change the world. So get us, so, and there are others that say, forget it. Individuals changing their lifestyles aren't going to change the world. We need social structural change. We need public policy change. We need corporate change. And there are others, there's a whole community of people that say the real issue is the stories we live by. We need a new story of the cosmos and not live by these stories of dominion, et cetera. So one of the things that's vital to me in teaching and in working with folks is to say none of these levels alone will do what needs to be done. All of them are vital and they open the doors to each other. They enable each other. A little example would be, and I haven't lived in Seattle for a number of years now, but I can remember when people started riding bikes. Mm-hmm. And it was for environmental reasons, and very committed. Like people would even carry their little babies behind them in buggies with little planets on them. That is a commitment. Because that is putting the common good, you know, over, it's risky. But more and more people riding bikes shifted public policy. Remember then bike lanes. Okay, they're imperfect, they need to be better, but bike lanes come into being. So individual actions shifted public policy. But what happens when public policy changes? So if we really get good public policy around bikes, so that Seattle or San Francisco looks like Amsterdam, where everyone's riding a bike, then if we really get public policy that makes it safe, more people are going to ride bikes. So that's an example of shifting. That's an example of those two levels interfacing with each other. Please.
Oh, and I would just say I feel like it also shifts the narrative of defining, like, what are we aspiring to? And I live in Portland, which is probably known for biking. It has its flaws, of course, but you know, I purposefully picked a place to live because I aspired to live a good life on a bicycle boulevard where I could bike my daughter to school, and it was not risky because the narrative had shifted.
Okay, so there you go. It does shift the narrative. So, and in subtle ways, doesn't it? Do you remember when plastic bags all of a sudden become illegal or whatever? And one day, everyone is hot. Do you know the dangers of plastic? The plastic industry was created by the fossil fuel industry. Go online and start looking at plastics. Incredibly dangerous environmentally, including climate-wise. Everyone is hauling plastic bags, mountains of plastic bags. If we use them all the time, the grocery store, put everything in plastic bags, single-use plastic. The next day, plastic bags are, the law is in place.
Yeah.
And what do you see? Everyone's carrying their little unplastic bags. So it was easy.
Yeah.
Can I just, going back to the bike thing, not to be pessimistic, but that particular war has, I live in Seattle and ride a bike there, has been going on for 40 years. Okay. And cyclists are killed weekly in Seattle. Yeah. It's not over. So I would just note, it hasn't worked. I mean, despite decades of attempts of individuals, it is still unresolved.
Yes, and so that is a beautiful example that we can use today. So it hasn't worked yet. What would make it work? Do you know what are the actions and the moves that would make it work? What are the public policy actions? What are the worldview actions? So let's maybe even use that as a case study. Because indeed, Seattle could look like Amsterdam. So what I would like you to do is,
it does help.
I would like us to, I have never been so far behind in plan as I am today. Oh my goodness. Okay.
That's why you put the clock in the back.
That's why I put the clock in the back. Okay, so let me just, I think I know what we're going to do. Let me tell you where we were going to go, and we will lead that into the next two sessions. I want you to work, not right now, because time is different than I thought it was, in some small conversation groups to really surface some of the changes in these five levels. To surface some of those changes, but not just examples of them. How I want you to surface how they impact the other levels. Because therein lies power. If you know that you're prioritizing change on the household level and the public policy level, then if you link that to changes on other levels, or see the impact it has on changes on other levels, that therein lies power. So we're going to work in some, do a little bit of surfacing those changes, examples of them we've seen, and also illustrations that could that we imagine. So that's one thing we'll do. But the other tool, that was the second tool, change on those levels. There's another tool that I'd like to, that we will put forth, but I'm going to put it forth now, and then we will work more on it in session three or four as I shift a little bit. And this tool is a, how many of you sort of like typologies, lists, categories? I do. This is what I call 10 fingers on the hands of social change, or 10 forms of action. And we'll play out these forms of action. So that will be the next tool, but we won't do that tool. We won't dig into that tool right now. The last tool, the fourth tool, is recalling that I am not primarily an I am a we. Okay. So you are not primary. We imagine ourselves as single actors. What if you reimagined yourself not as a single actor, but part of a whole cloud of witnesses? A whole body, a whole community of communities throughout the globe that is moving toward justice-seeking and earth-honoring ways of life. That is one of the gifts of the church, is the church actually tells us, though we don't often hear it, that we're not just eyes. We're woven into a body. When we're baptized, we're woven into a body. When we celebrate the Eucharist, do you know the words in the New Testament? Do you know, I love serving the Eucharist. I love saying this is the body of Christ given for you. But that you is
plural.
It's plural. Y'all know it. It's plural. So we shouldn't even say that. We should say this is the body of Christ given for you and for y'all. So inherently, you're not just getting the body of Christ. So the imagining, the reimagining of, I try to do this. That's what I did. Tried to do in our opening worship, in our opening Thanksgiving today, to recognize that even as contained within apparent individualness, we're not. We're trillions of organisms, needing the trees in order to breathe. But remember that we are co-laborers, collaborators in communion with bodies of people throughout the world. So if your church decides to engage in a tree planting campaign, to be part of a coalition that's planting trees, maybe do it. Get a hold of the tree planting campaign being done by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tanzania has a tree bishop. due to work planting trees, a tree planting campaign. So be in collaboration with that, or if your church decides to do support community-based agriculture. One of the vital forms of change is localized food, regional food, rather than hauling. Yes. You know, the best example, did we talk about this, is apples in Washington State importing apples from Chile. So what's the carbon footprint of an apple coming from Chile? So if your church decides to support local agriculture, get in touch with the coalition of black small farmers. Support that coalition of black small farmers. Recognize working together and the power of working together. And as a part of shifting the narrative of I as an I, we're trained in modernity to think of ourselves as autonomous moral agents. So what I can do is what I can do. I as an I cannot shift this. Right. I as an I, that's defeat. It's morally defeating to think of what I can do. But I as part of a we, that's not morally defeating. That's not morally defeating at all. There's a rising movement to make a difference in this. So my fourth tool, so the first tool was moral spiritual vision with seeing three things at once. The second tool, what was the second tool? Five levels of society, household, institutions of civil society, business, public policy, and worldview. The next tool that we looked at, that we're going to look at, is 5-10 fingers on the hands of social change. And the fourth tool was reimagining me as a we, rather than an I. And so I'd like you to muse about that. And then we shall shift our plans a little bit tomorrow, and then, or the fourth day, to flesh out more the second and the third tools. Now we need to part ways, I know. If you would just take a minute and turn to look at one another, so you can maybe look at one person in the eyes. Does everybody have one person? Who doesn't? Like one person? Just a minute. Raise your hand if you don't have a person. Look at that person. You two can look at each other in the eyes and honor. Let your eyes tell that person, I honor the courage and the moral power in you. Don't even say it. Use your eyes. I honor. And receive that. That is someone honoring the moral courage and power in you. Wow. Drink it in. Okay. We shall part ways and come back again.